Good afternoon, everybody. We'll get started with our afternoon session here, More Than Music. And our first presenters are Amanda DiBattista and Andrew Mark. They're PhD students in the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University in Toronto. And while Andrew is an ethnomusicologist and Amanda is an eco-critic, they have come together to collaborate on Coherence, a podcast series that looks at the intersections of culture, history, and the environment. To date, they have produced 4 episodes, and 6 more are in the works, 3 more in 2012, and 3 more for the 2013 season. Their pilot season has been successful at generating discussion within the Canadian environmental studies community about a range of topics, including melancholy and mourning, environmental despair, hegemony of the arts, literature and politics, and eco-poetry. Upcoming episodes will focus on food and social inequality, protest and resistance at the G20 in Toronto, queer urban ecology, women's environmental health, and urban food politics. And we'll bring up Andrew and Amanda.
In a recent article entitled Soundscapes, Towards a Sounded Anthropology, authors Samuels, Mijentes, Ochoa, and Porcello proposed that sound art, and soundscapes need recognition as unique documents worthy of serious academic attention. They argue that field recordings are understood as ethnographic fieldwork data and are rarely considered ends in themselves, but rather as means for description and transcription into text. Admittedly, there are other uses of sound recording for albums, for archives, for language recovery, etc. But these authors set about not to unseat the ultimate academic product, the publication, but to locate a place for the sound recording alongside it.
As PhD students with complex programs of study and busy lives, our supervisors, while supportive of our decision to seek funding for a podcast series, were concerned that the project would take more time and energy than predicted. They were also concerned because this project does not fall nicely into those traditional academic products normally associated with advancing academic careers. We are here today before you in part because we are searching for ways for our work to take on those more traditionally quantifiable academic forms. We imagine our work as occupying an ecotone, a transitional ecosystem with great biodiversity between art and academic, between journalism and ethnography. On a PhD resume, it's quite possible that a presentation at ARSC will carry more weight than a series of audio podcasts. In this room, we may all have a good idea of how to evaluate the quality of our podcasts as academic documents, but within a field as varied as environmental studies, this work is largely unquantifiable. What does a peer review even sound like? And so, between our two solitudes, art and academic, as infotainment, our place is uncertain.
The medium we have chosen by itself signifies complexities about communication that confuse those more comfortable with text in academia. Podcasts are perceived as an extension of Facebook and Twitter, new and social media. In reality, though, the best example of popular podcasts are radio shows on demand that take full advantage of modern production possibilities that have come with more publicly accessible recording equipment and software, and an increase in recording literacy. We contend that in the main, academics have used their access to this equipment to produce only poor quality archival references or copies. For example, if you want to take Intro to Biology at Yale, you're free to do so through iTunes U. Never mind that the lectures, paper presentations, and plenary discussions are not designed for an exclusively oral audience, or that they are dead boring with poor fidelity, or that they often include references to things happening off mic, like PowerPoint slides, dramatic gestures, props, or that they are up there on the internet for public consumption, though they are as impenetrable as any text.
Though the podcasting medium may be a relatively new information delivery system, what is equally complex is the subject matter of our particular podcasts. This double barrier of medium and message mandates that our delivery and promotion be nuanced as we try to reach our potential audience. Take, for example, our episode on hegemony and the arts. We used Gramsci's theoretical framework of hegemony to illustrate different examples of practical and community-based research within our faculty. In this clip, note the use of music, narration, and editing to set up these complex concepts.
The other way to look at hegemony is that it's a way to organize society so that it seems natural that the vast majority of us work for the differential benefit of a few. And so it seems natural that you have a huge middle class, a large poor class, and a very small, wealthy, rich, or obscenely rich class, and that the middle class and the working class, as disorganized as that might be, should work to produce wealth that is appropriated and redistributed to a small minority is another aspect of hegemony, that naturalness. And so the arts, again, recapitulate that in that we structure our arts hierarchically. All of the stuff that people do on a day-to-day basis has disappeared, you know, in that notion of art. So we have high art and low art.
This feels really Orwellian. And intuitively, my common sense tells me that the best arts rise to the top, even though I know, as a professional gigging musician, that this is not the case at all.
We decided to talk to Heather McLean to find out just how deep the rabbit hole goes, how controlled art production is, who gets the funding, and for whom the work is created to consume. Her specific interest is in Toronto. Here's Heather.
The City of Toronto has something called the Culture Plan for the Creative City. It's the guiding document for arts and culture planning in Toronto. And in 2003, they developed this plan with small areas for community consultation. They have a lot of private sector experts and think tank experts and people that write about arts and creativity develop the plan, and then you have a few opportunities for people who work in the arts to actually contribute. They're developing a new plan in 2011. They asked people from the arts to come and contribute. What I found interesting was both the 2003 plan and the plan they're developing now. The way the policy is written, all of the language talks about arts and culture are important for making Toronto competitive. Arts and culture make us a prosperous, competitive city. Like, we're culture capital of the world. And they're telling a group of people, a lot of youth and youth of color from like Scarborough and Etobicoke, people that do really neat urban arts work. They're telling this room full of youth, because of you, you make Toronto competitive, and we need you to make this the arts scene cool, and we have to compete with all these countries. So there's a real language of competition, and it's that's the kind of... with my work, I look at these think tanks that are behind that kind of language.
In the fall, we attended a conference focused on the importance of literature and environmental politics. We recorded the keynote speakers, interviewed attendees and presenters, and sometime after the event, we sat down with the conference organizers to discuss their experiences. We've used this material to produce a double episode airing this month. Here is Catriona Sandilands, who organized Green Words, Green Worlds, speaking to the need for such a conference within the Canadian eco-critical community.
The specific topic of the conference came from a number of different sources. I have found over the years, and this is not a problem that is confined to the Faculty of Environmental Studies, a gradual diminishment of the humanities, a diminishment of funding in the humanities, a certain lack of understanding of the real contribution that literature, history, philosophy make to fields outside. This is happening at a societal level. There have been articles about crises in the humanities for a dozen years, but it seems to have been particularly acute in the interdisciplinary world of environmental studies, in which literature is, you know, a nice way of communicating environmental ideas, or music is a nice way of tarting up, you know, the really important work that people in the environmental studies do regarding, you know, sustainable energy or environmental policy or economics. Perhaps particularly because I approach the humanities as a reformed social scientist, all of my degrees are actually in sociology. I have always found that literature in particular offers moments and kinds of illumination that are just not represented by other kinds of disciplines.
Kate's commentary encapsulates our own dilemma as podcast producers and leads us to interrogate our own practice from the perspective of environmental studies. What moments and kind of illumination can podcasting provide that other mediums may not? One of our goals is to build upon the surprising consensus we find within a discipline that is constantly being told and is telling itself that it is dissolving in interdisciplinarity. We also aim to foster, celebrate, and validate the environmental studies community. Here's an audio mashup from the Green Words, Green Worlds Conference that we feel accomplishes our goals of consensus building and solidarity.
One of the things that I find so important about this kind of gathering is the sense that...
I think that writing in and of itself is a political act, and it's important to think about it in those terms.
Trying to reintegrate those things that have so often been understood separately.
Looking at the environment both from a spiritual and historical and contemporary perspective.
At the same time, I think it has to be in coordination with other acts.
First Nations people suddenly found themselves writing in the language of the colonizer. They were forced to learn English to address land issues, disempowerment.
What are the different tactics or strategies that people need, and how do they coordinate or align or not, you know?
Emotional life and somatic life is central to our political life.
Writing by Aboriginal peoples, whether it is focusing on land issues, water issues, the environment in general, or education, whatever, it is in a sense a political act because it comes from that tradition.
My name is Rita Wong.
My name is Armand Garnet Rufo.
I'm Janine McLeod.
I'm Molly Wallace.
So I find this a really exciting gathering, and I was very inspired by all of the speakers this evening. It was wonderful.
This has been an amazing experience, so energizing, exactly what a conference should be, which just is witnessing all of these brilliant, energetic people at work and being inspired to be more brilliant and energetic in response.
Now, another way that we work towards our goal of building consensus and solidarity within the environmental studies community is through collaboration with other PhD students. To this end, our podcasting practice is moving increasingly towards the inclusion of guest producers, PhD students who are cultivating their expertise in a particular area and who draw on their networks for episode topics and material. These collaborations are an opportunity for guest producers to experiment with the new media, to explore and present their research in new ways and to a different audience, and to build a varied skill set that podcasting requires. These collaborations are also an opportunity for us to share our workload and expertise, to engage with topics and individuals that we may not have otherwise, and to imagine the future of our project. We believe that it is in this way that we are not only building a community around coherence podcasting, but also contributing to the production of a digital commons in which ideas are freely exchanged and equal political conversations are facilitated.
We are also committed to providing workshops to those interested in using podcasting as part of their own activist, pedagogical, or research practice. We've presented both within our faculty and at a summer institute for teachers in the Toronto District School Board, and we'll be providing a workshop at the Environmental Studies and Communication Association at the end of this month. These workshops cover the technical basics of sound recording and editing and provide participants with an opportunity to discuss interview strategies, dissemination and marketing techniques, as well as sound design and the aesthetics of podcasting. By offering individuals in a diverse range of communities the opportunity to handle sound recording equipment and to consider the possibilities of podcasting for their own practice, we hope to make podcasting more accessible within the environmental studies and education communities. And we hope to explore new ways that podcasts can be used to discuss environmental issues.
Ideally, we want our podcast to reflect the type of scholarship and attention to orality that Samuels, Mijentes, Ochoa, and Porcello call for in their paper. In the midst of many constraints, we strive for a podcasting practice that is, on the one hand, creative and artistic, placing emphasis on sound quality, music, and technical expertise. On the other hand, our podcasts are an academic pursuit, one that places communicability and rigorous research on equal footing. Samuels et al. Say that, quote, treating recordings as integral components of a sounded anthropology and equal partners in a theoretical conversation stands to refine and advance that conversation. We hope that by making our recordings integral components of a sounded environmental studies and equal partners in that theoretical conversation, our podcasting practice will contribute to and advance conversations in environmental studies in meaningful ways. While we are still learning, here's an example of the type of podcasting we are working towards.
Wondering if you can tell me a little bit more about how you see your practice as a writer and as an educator as well as an overtly political as an overtly political act.
Interrogating the boundaries between nature and culture, or even between discourses of science and art. I think those are political things to do, especially. I really see, you know, I think we live right now in an age when discourses of truth and falsity are largely determined by scientific discourse. Mm-hmm. And so I see that there is a role there for art to intervene in that. To provide different frames of signification so that we can look at things differently in order to... raise questions, but also to... provide textual interventions. Which ultimately, I mean, I see my project as combining disparate discourses, not as a means of destroying or undermining those discourses themselves, but showing, first of all, the ways in which they overlap and how this is productive, but also in the ways in which they interrupt each other and the spaces they provide for thinking differently. Polysyndeton is the rhetorical use of conjunctions in close succession and the repetition of words like and. I see it as an example of a linguistic polymer. Polysyndeton. Make a roof for the people, and the people walk down the street with resin for a roof, and the roof has magnesium in it and sulfur, and the people walk down the street with resin in their hair, and resins are always falling from the sky to the ground, and the birds make a people in the sky, the people of the resin, and the resin is composed of sky, and it composes the sky, and the people walking down the street are the strings of resins, and covering their hair with their arms, with newspapers, with umbrellas, the people are the birds of resins, throwing their landings in the air like people for whom landings are uncommon, like people committed to the expulsion of landings, the resins coming down upon them like people driven out of countries discovered by resins, or that have discovered resins in veins in the countertops of suburbs, and people walk down the street with resins for hair, with countries committed to color, with the bonds between them, the birds circling, and people walking down the street with hunched shoulders so as not to look up and call the resins by name, call the resins in the name of the birds, the people circling and loosening.
Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you, Andrew and Amanda. We'll have some time for some questions. Andrew has one thing to add first.
Let's see. This is an image of our show notes. So after people hear our podcast, then they can go and follow up on the citations that people we've spoken to make, and there's links to blogs and things, stuff like that. And here's an image of the handout that we passed around. It's just an ecosystem model of producing a podcast that we hope to kind of to bring to other audiences. I imagine that many people here probably can see how this would go into producing a podcast. But that's it. So if anybody has any questions. Originally, our first two episodes were hosted by a show that had a very good following. It's called Nature's Past, and it deals with environment and history. But to be honest, part of why we're coming to conferences like this and doing things is in order that we can network and find out about those kinds of communities I'm aware that they're out there. But we're learning about how that all happens. I bring a lot of production skills to our team, but I don't know how to make those networking connections in the radio universe. So we'd love to hear about how to reach out to radio stations. Yeah.
That's really one of our challenges is trying to figure out ways to partner with people and trying to figure out how to get our podcast sort of out into this sort of nebulous universe that the internet is, right? We're still really at the beginning of our process. We're just putting out our fourth episode, so I think those are connections that we have yet to make in light of all the other sort of constraints that we have, because we're just the two of us. So, we should probably, I don't even know if York has a radio station. I feel like in Toronto, there used to be really fabulous community or campus radio stations, and I feel like they're sort of declining, and I don't know if I'm out of step speaking in like.
As is the CBC, which you may hear, but yeah.
Yeah.
I have a question, actually. We were talking a little bit before this panel, and Andrew, you have a background in ethnomusicology, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with the work of Stephen Feld in particular and others who create soundscapes as an ethnographic documentary type of medium, and if you consider what you two are doing as how you would position that in relation, do you consider it to be an outgrowth or an offshoot of it or just something entirely different?
I can say we submitted one of our podcasts to Sensate, which is a new journal everybody should find out about. It's a very interesting journal that's doing sort of new media, and they've just come out, and they're trying to figure out how to peer review things like podcasts. However, they felt that we didn't really fit into their world because we were dealing too much with what people were actually saying. Rather than dealing with it as an art piece or a soundscape, we weren't enough audio for this particular journal, which was really interesting because, again, we're in between. You know, the academics don't feel we're academic enough. The art people don't feel we're art enough. In terms of soundscape and Stephen Feld, I'm familiar with some of his earlier work. I do think that there's a space in this project for acoustic ecology and that kind of work. But thus far, we haven't. I can't say that we've gone down that road, really. I've experimented with creating sound environments behind things that people are saying, And there have been instances when, like a film, I've been able to make something that somebody may have, we may have done an interview with somebody and they were very neutral. They're very neutral, very informative. But if I put the right background behind them, all of a sudden, I don't know, they sound particularly eloquent and maybe angry. You know, if you put a soundscape behind them with thunder or something like that. I mean, these are obvious things, but I think it's pretty interesting in terms of semiotics and signing and those kinds of things that Felt talks about.
All right. Great. Thank you very much, Amanda and Andrew.